Welcome everyone to a very special new seminar series. It's our great honor to welcome back Dr. John Wilson, our good friend. His topic is Puritan and Presbyterian, a British and American history. Please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
I would like to take a second to ask us also to thank Sarah and Ted, who over so many years have done so much to keep this going, often with very different committees, this time with John Hayes. John, thank you too. But the variety of speakers, the quality of speakers, all of that is due, I think, almost entirely over the years to Sarah and Ted. So okay, you see the big guy up there? That was painted by Hans Holbein, the famous German portrait artist. And it was a year or so before his death. He was quite ill, so he doesn't look ill up there, but he was. Remember, he had effectively broken his leg and took a long, long time to heal, and it had never really healed. And he will die from that wound. I have, so the big guy, he really was a tyrant. No question about it. People died, lots of people died under his rule, also for religious reasons. Religious reasons were rarely the reason given for a killing. It was usually, whether it was religious or not, traitor. They were traitors to the crown. So no question about it. The guy deservedly has a bad reputation. And yet there's a side of him we just miss. And that's why I'd like to go to the next slide, Ted. This is a couple of years before he declares himself head of the Church of England, moves the Pope out, will no longer be loyal to the Pope, but will maintain a Catholic dogma, Catholic service. But this is a couple of years before that. And you notice a little scroll underneath, and that scroll has a Latin statement, and it says, and this may be the surprise, go into the whole world and preach the gospel to all creatures. Because Henry had a very religious side. He was, in fact, a deeply religious person in spite of all the other things he was. And we owe the beginnings of Reformation in England to Henry. Really to Henry. He declares himself head of the church, and the parliament will agree, declaring him head of the church in 1534. And he doesn't just sit up there doing nothing. He takes direct interest in the doings of the church, what's going on, what's being said, what's believed, all of those things he's directly involved in. So he's not only a titular head, a figurehead, he is a spiritual head who takes specific interest in what's going on. And that's another reason why you shouldn't cross Henry. You get on his bad side. That was very bad. Now, go to the next slide. And we get a timeline. And this timeline is very important. You get the Henry's dates. You see 1509 to 1547. And you can make a comparison with the reformers. Luther died 1546, Calvin 1564, and Zwingli, of course, died on the battlefield, a relatively young man, in 1531. He declares himself supreme head of the Church of England, and the Parliament will agree, 1534. Now, the big kicker for that, why it happens, is that he's so very concerned that he does not have a son. He's married to a woman, a Spanish princess, Catherine, had been married to her for some years. She had one healthy child, Mary, but she had a series of miscarriages or stillborn children. And Henry began to feel like this was some sort of, wouldn't exactly say curse, but something hanging over the problem with Catherine, that she could not have a healthy male child, which is what he wanted, to carry on the line. So he's thinking of, he needs a son, and his advisors help him think about this. And they come up with, well, an annulment of the marriage, and the Pope could give this. Well, the Pope had done it before, had given an annulment or something very much like this. So Cardinal Wolsey, who is very much Henry's servant, helps him in all ways. Now a fairly old man, cardinal, supposedly interacting between the Pope and the King in England. He goes about the business of trying to get an annulment from the Pope. Well, the unfortunate thing is that the Pope is directly related to Henry's wife, and she doesn't want a divorce. So the Pope does not cooperate. Now, this is again odd because he'd done it before. He had allowed annulments. So Henry, he's being advised as to what can be done about this. And of course, naming himself head of the church sounds quite radical, but the idea had been out there before. He didn't invent it. Back in the 1300s, John Wycliffe had recommended that the king become head of the church because he saw the church as corrupt. The monks, priests, and so forth, he thought, set them in good order. Let the king do it. He's got the power. Then there was another one, Marsilius of Padua, the Defensor Pacis, defender of the peace, also in the 1300s, Italian. He recommends that the head of state also be head of the church. And he very narrowly misses being killed for having said that. A prince in Germany will give him support and give him refuge. So he's out of the way of the danger of being killed. And then we have Luther. Martin Luther, one of the great Reformation tracts, 1520, 22. One of them is the address to the nobles of the German nation. And you know what the address is. The church will not reform itself. Let the nobles take over. Let the nobles do it. So there was precedence here. So Henry will proceed. Cardinal Wolsey will help him. He will get the divorce, or not get the divorce. He will just divorce himself. And marry, of course, Anne Boleyn, who is the mother of Elizabeth, right? And then, unfortunately, there's rumors about her being faithless and so forth, so she loses her head. Remember Henry's six wives. You ever heard of the scheme to understand how the six wives go? It's divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, died. And you can go through them. It works. It works. By the way, the last of his queens, Catherine Parr, was Protestant. She cared for the children. By that time, there were three, Mary, Elizabeth, and young Edward. She will care for those children like a mother. And they talked about it later. And there's a scandalous film. I happened to come across this. We'll mention it. It's called Firebrand, and it's out there on Amazon or whatever now. It's the life of Catherine Parr, totally distorted. At the end of the film, they make her kill Henry so she's not betrayed as a Protestant. Well, that's total invention. And all the way through, it's invention. Well, of course, Hollywood does that all the time. They take any history and reinvent it. I don't care how true they think they're being, it's not. Well, Henry, with his learning, very learned, he speaks different languages, reads and speaks different languages. He's quite bright, very bright guy, as was Anne Boleyn, by the way. So Elizabeth, very, very smart woman, had smart parents. Henry reads. He reads a lot, and he's reading in religious literature. He's reading Luther. That is most current for him at the time. And of course, Luther is being brought into the country illegally by merchants who are coming in. They're bringing Luther's tracts, Luther's writings. And they are spreading all over because they're catching a lot of interest. And Henry is reading and discussing. And he will have this archbishop, a bishop that he lifts out of service and makes archbishop, Thomas Cranmer. And Thomas becomes his most trusted advisor. That's very interesting, because someone who's very close to him and can tell him practically anything that Cranmer wants to discuss. And Cranmer's a Protestant. He begins as a Catholic, but very quickly, in the 20s, after Luther's writings begin to come in, and then on into the 30s, Cranmer becomes a Protestant. Indeed, one of his missions into Europe took him into Germany as a legate from the king, where he went into Lutheran Germany, and he married the daughter of Osiander, who was one of Luther's students, pupils, a major student. So he's married. Now, Catholic priests weren't supposed to get married. But this is another tract of Luther's having to do with the freedom of priests to marry, which Luther himself naturally did. Well, Cranmer will marry, but he'll also keep it a secret. Not all that well kept a secret, but he does try very hard to keep it secret when he gets back to England. Henry doesn't seem to mind. He's not paying any attention to it anyway. But it's Cranmer who brings Henry into awareness of all that this new Protestant movement means. And what we see from Henry is kind of an off and on. His writings, where he's favoring things, what he's doing for the church. Sometimes he's going Protestant, and then he'll kick back Catholic. And the final thing is, he will go back toward the Catholic. That is to say, no Pope, but Catholic order, Catholic dogma, Catholic way of running the church. So back and forth. And in this back and forth, there are martyrs that, especially because the bishops themselves, there isn't a great deal of done to change the bishops. They are still the bishops in their diocese, and they will bring the charges of heresy. And then it's referred to the state, not necessarily directly to Henry. He may have been involved or not involved, but Protestants, as Catholics who would not keep to the order, were martyred during this time. So it's an on and off. And then the most interesting thing about Henry is he doesn't seem to mind Protestant dogma, Protestant theology. One of the commentaries said, what he seems to care for is outer form. If the forms are there, namely the Catholic forms, he doesn't mind if you fill it with Protestant content. So the words, change the words. I've seen that reflected in a couple of commentators, historians, talking about this inner and outer for Henry, the outer forms. Now, this will have a history, too. Just to come back before we leave the timeline, Supreme William Tyndale, the first translation of this period of time. There had been earlier English translations, not very good ones, usually taken straight out of the Latin of the Vulgate, the Catholic Bible. Tyndale is translating out of the Greek and the Hebrew. He's Protestant, he is Lutheran, he is English, and he will be martyred. He will finally be martyred, he will burn. That's the other thing. Heretics typically met death by burning. They could be humanely dealt with, that is to say, while they were tied to the post before the fire started, they could be throttled from behind, choked, so that they don't experience the flames. But serious heretics felt the flames. And Cranmer will himself be martyred. He will burn under Mary, Queen Mary, when we get that far. But I'll come back to that. Thomas Cromwell. There's a TV series going on right now about Thomas Cromwell, which is to be recommended. It's well done. The first part of it, it's BBC, BBC production. First part of it's called Wolf Hall. The second part is Light and Life. I think it's current right now. They are making it. One episode has come out, and others will be appearing. It's quite well done. Cromwell, after Wolsey, Cardinal Wolsey, becomes the over time the chief of state for Henry, and Cromwell has Protestant leanings. He's well aware of Protestantism. He reads Protestant literature. He does keep his head down. He doesn't try to provoke Henry, but it's pretty well known that his biases, his preferences, his beliefs are essentially Protestant. So he lasts a long time as chief of state or as serving Henry up until 1540. And that's when you see Henry will. Yes, he will be accused of treason finally, and it has to do with the Anne of Cleves affair. This is when Cromwell manages to facilitate the possibility of a real treaty, military treaty between the German Lutheran princes and Henry. And part of this is this marriage to a German princess, Anne of Cleves. So without ever having met her, she's brought to England and there is a marriage and Henry just does not like her. This is bust, right? The wrong thing. It lasts about a week before he sends her back. And this is one of those divorces. Well, this becomes an occasion for Cromwell's enemies to bring in other charges. And finally, Cromwell's head falls. 1540. Henry will later say he wished he hadn't done that to Thomas Cromwell, that he had kept him, because he was the best advisor he had ever had. And Thomas Cromwell really had pretty much run the kingdom for Henry. The Great Bible, 1539. This was a big, heavy, bulky Bible chained to the pulpits of the major churches. And it was ordered by Henry. Now, this is another event in Protestantism, because Catholics did not emphasize in any way laity reading the Bible or putting the Bible up in some sort of prominent position in the church. It was based on Tyndale's work. It had been a revision of what Tyndale had done. But to put it there and certainly give the suggestion anyone opening that Bible could read it, not just clergy. So it's a sign, too, of Henry's leanings toward what's going on in Protestantism. Then we have Edward, the boy prince. You remember the stories about Edward, that he was the sickly prince? You remember those? Then he never was healthy. Well, recent research has demonstrated that he was quite healthy until the last year of his life. And he was Henry's pride and joy. He grew up very straight and tall, was very bright, and he was very Protestant. He was very, very Protestant. We could cite the influence of Cranmer, again, the Archbishop. And it's under Edward that we get the major works of the English Church, the Book of Common Prayer, the 39 Articles of the Church of England. Those come up, are authored and accepted in the church under Edward as the work of Thomas Cranmer. The 39 Articles, 1551, the prayer book. Well, let's take a look at some of these people. The next slide you see is Cranmer, Thomas Cranmer. Two different pictures, one earlier, one later. And one of the stories is what you often see are men with these long beards. And yet before that, you see he doesn't have a long beard. And the story goes that Protestant churchmen would grow beards to distinguish themselves from Catholics who didn't grow beards, which is kind of funny. Luther, you never saw with a beard. He never grew a beard. But Calvin certainly did. He had a beard, and others. Well, and then the next picture, the next slide, Edward, young Edward the Sixth. You see his death date. If you go remember what was in the timeline, age 16 years, 8 months. And Edward was a very active king, took a definite interest in religious things and in political things. And he made decisions. He would tell people. Now, certainly, he had helped the family of the Boleyns and also a Somerset family. They were also Protestants, had much to do with his upbringing as a child. But he made decisions. One of his decisions was that Mary, the daughter of Henry VIII, by Catherine, that first wife, who was Catholic, that Mary should not be queen because she's too Catholic. That wasn't itself the problem. He knew she would try very hard to reverse Reformation in England. And Cranmer knew it. So the point was to keep her from being queen. Now, as the story goes, and I don't quite understand why to disqualify Mary, he had to disqualify Elizabeth, his other sister. It's the three of them with Edward. Edward, yes. So he disqualifies Elizabeth and Mary. And you remember who he declares as his successor? Lady Jane Grey. She was eligible to be queen because she was the daughter of Henry's sister, granddaughter of Henry's sister, not the direct daughter, the granddaughter. So she stood in line by birth to be queen. So she was named actually queen when Edward died. He determined that she should be named queen, and she was. She was named queen, and she's the famous 18-day queen, because as soon as she's declared queen, Mary goes out and collects a Catholic army to march back on London, claiming the throne. And the interesting thing is that the country more or less falls in line behind Mary. So poor Lady Jane Grey, by the time Mary gets to London, there's just a great deal of support. There's a Privy Council. They do not continue to support Lady Jane Grey, who's already been declared queen. So Jane Grey, a fairly young woman, don't remember the exact age right now, but she was young. I think she was in her teens, something like 17. Goes to the Tower, and initially Mary doesn't want to have her executed, but after a while she perceives that there's a threat there to her own majesty as the new queen, and Lady Jane Grey is beheaded. That's the end of that. And Mary definitely then does try to reverse the Reformation, everything back to Catholic. Okay, the slide on where you see Mary at the top. Mary's rule, 1553 to 1558. She dies of a very mysterious illness. She thinks she's pregnant, then she's not. She marries, wants very much to have a child, just like Henry did, to carry on the family tradition and re-Catholicizing. So the country is re-Catholicized. This is what she tries to do. And it's surprisingly successful. Let's say there's not a great deal of opposition. There are still bishops. Cranmer doesn't purge the bishops. Henry never purged the bishops to make sure they're all Protestant. No, very many are still Catholic. And there is rejoicing in the remnants of the Catholic population that they're going to re-Catholicize. Now, the problem with it, if Mary had not died, if she had had a longer life, it could well have succeeded, but she didn't. She became quite ill, again, thinking that she was pregnant. She was not, but she died of whatever it was that was going on with her. But she institutes a policy of persecution. And there's a very famous persecution. 300 mainly clergy, Protestant clergy, bishops and so forth, are burned, and burned not mercifully, but burned terribly, including Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer is burned. By this time, Thomas Cromwell is no longer there. He's already been lost his head. He's out. But there's a terrible persecution, and it is after Mary's death, quite quickly, a man by the name of Fox. He is a Protestant clergyman, will write Fox's Book of Martyrs, which becomes the hallmark event of the death of Mary and her persecution. 300 burnings, not entirely 300, close to it though. So a terrible persecution, a very public persecution because people could see it, was always done in public. And those being burnt drew a great deal of sympathy. People sympathized with them. Actually, it added to the Protestant cause to see this happening, reaction again against the Catholicizing. Fox's Book of Martyrs would go on to be printed several times during Elizabeth's reign, and with illustrations, famous illustrations. And it will be ordered to be chained to the pulpit along with the Bible in the major Protestant churches, Fox's Book of Martyrs. All right, Elizabeth, now we come to the most fascinating figure in the whole of the history. Elizabeth's reign, she was there for a long time. Very, very long time. And the saying is, people were fanatically loyal to her. Something about Elizabeth, even though she wasn't so in front of the public, she commanded a huge loyalty from the people. And she was Protestant. But she had the problem of having so many people in England who were Catholic. Let us say from Henry, especially from the reign of Mary, a whole lot of people had come out as Catholics and openly as Catholics. Remember before, one of the things I did not say was there was a law under Edward. There was a law under Henry. But there was very important law under Edward VI that said it was the act of uniformity. Everyone had to be members of the Church of England. And there was a requirement of attendance to a Eucharist, celebration of the Eucharist, at least once a year. But everyone as a member of the church, whether you were Catholic, whether you were not so strong a Protestant or whatever, was a requirement to attend the Church of England under Edward, which meant with the prayer book and with the 39 articles. when Elizabeth comes to the throne, she has the problem of having a very large population of Catholics who have either converted under Mary or were always Catholic before, and have just come out as Catholic without any reservation. And she has the problem of uniting the country. Now you can say, well, why care? But she does. She wants to, as much as possible, unite the country. So we have a new act of uniformity. Now this is conforming to the Church of England. It's the same thing, everyone has to belong to the Church of England. But there's this Elizabethan settlement. You see that, the Elizabethan settlement. The settlement was, they're going to have, and this becomes standard for the Church of England still today. Elizabeth said it. They're going to have Catholic appearances, Catholic ceremonies, vestments, for example, but with a Protestant theology. Catholic outside, Protestant inside. What does it sound like? Sounds like Henry, right? But this is what Elizabeth commands. Catholic vestments, Catholic ceremony, Protestant theology. And here we get to Puritans. Now the Puritans, why Puritan? What does Puritan mean? Well, when we think of Puritan, we usually think New England Puritans, those who migrated 1620, 1630 to England, New England. That's not true. The word Puritan comes up already before Elizabeth, and then during Elizabeth's period, as those who want to purify the Church of Catholic elements. That's where the whole word comes from. And it's kind of funny, we get misconceptions about Puritans, like they're all teetotalers, they don't drink, and they do, also in New England. I thought it was kind of funny, reading in the history, you come across information that's kind of striking, like Plymouth Colony, they receive a shipment of beer because that's what they drank. They drank beer. And this, what's funny about this one is one shipment of 4 tons of beer until they got around to being able to manufacture it themselves. That was their daily drink. Now you can say, well, certainly they had learned long since water could be a problem. Beer had that purification. It was hard to get my mind around that 4 tons of beer being shipped in once into Boston. But Elizabeth stuck very strongly to this. And Puritans, if they objected too strongly to her, what she wanted, and made a big problem of it, she would slap them in prison. So there were a good many Puritans in prison. Now, what about the Presbyterians? Presbyterians, we don't really have a Presbyterian party yet because we don't have a clear definition of what a Presbyterian is yet. What we have are these Puritans. Among them are more Lutheran Puritans. And others are more Calvinist Lutherans because they're getting these different kinds of influence coming into England, especially through Cranmer. Cranmer initially is very Lutheran biased. We see that in his works. And afterwards, when he gets to know Calvin and Calvinism, he changes in that direction. And you see the change, especially in his understanding of the Eucharist. Early, when he's in his Lutheran period, he will accept Luther's the real presence of Christ in the sacrament. It's not transubstantiation like the Catholics say, but like Luther says, it's the real presence. When he shifts over into his Calvinist period, we get the wording spiritually present. What comes down to us in the prayer book? The Calvinist side. Spiritually present. Now, what we get already under Cranmer and under Henry, you have to remember the continuity coming from Henry. Outer forms, Catholic, inner content, Protestant. And that's what we get very strongly from Cranmer. Outer forms are Catholic, the inner content, the theology is Protestant. That's important. Because Puritans will say, Puritans will object. If you keep those forms, they're going to lead you right back to the Catholic Church. Those forms are Catholic. We have not conformed the Church to what the New Testament tells us the Church should be. Now here, there's a big argument in England about this, huge argument among the theologians, the nobles, and so forth. Are the ceremonies things that the state or the church can decide for itself? Are there traditions that the church can keep? Or do you have to conform to the New Testament? And the Puritans are saying, conformity. Purify the church of these elements. The other side is saying, no, no, we can have Catholic theology and these traditional forms. That's Cranmer, that's Henry, that's Elizabeth. And she enforces it. So we get a Puritan objection. The whole time Elizabeth is queen, Parliament is steadily becoming more Puritan. By the time we get to the end of her reign, historians are saying that Parliament is Puritan. And it's not only Puritan, it's becoming Presbyterian. Okay, what would you think is the characteristic? What would separate a Puritan? Let's say Protestants, you know, Puritans, Presbyterians. What separates Presbyterian from Puritan back then? Only one thing, because they essentially had the same belief. It was through the prayer book, through Calvinist theology, reading the Bible, all of these things were there. What made Presbyterians Presbyterian and separated them out as Presbyterian? Polity. The way the church is organized. Elders. Presbyter means elder, right? So a church ruled by elders. Preaching elders, deacons and so forth, all of these effectively as elders in the church, ruled by elders, with synods, where they collect together, synods, presbyters, ministers, to decide things about the church. So some is in the congregation, and a lot of authority there is in the presbytery. That's what becomes the distinguished Presbyterians. Now, why did Presbyterians suddenly appear? Why did Puritans become or realize they were Presbyterians? Because they said, as long as there are bishops, the church is never going to change. The only way we can get the change in the church we actually need is to adopt a Presbyterian form of organizing the church, the congregations. And we will have a national church that is Presbyterian. So this becomes the hallmark, the clear recognition sign of Presbyterians. There wasn't really a big dogmatic difference because the prayer book itself was very Protestant. They didn't question that. They did question the fact that there were forms in the prayer book that looked Catholic. There were points where you had to kneel. And that's a major point. Cranmer will have you in the prayer book, will have you kneel. Now, that's still in the prayer book, kneeling. And let's go to that. We have the black rubric, Ted, the next one. Okay, now here you see an example of the problem. This is the most famous example of the problem of the prayer book. Prayer book of 1552. Now, there had been a prayer book, a previous prayer book, when apparently Cranmer was more in his Lutheran stage, in which the kneeling is there without any qualification. So it's like the real presence. Christ is truly present. By the time we have the prayer book of 1552, Cranmer is now in his Calvinist period. And there is need to explain why the kneeling. So the black rubric, remember a rubric that's red and it gives directions in the prayer book. It's what to do at this point, like get on your knees or something, right? And the black rubric meant it was in black print and not in red. Okay, 1552, it explained that kneeling was an expression of humble and grateful acknowledging of the benefits of Christ given to the worthy receiver, and did not imply any adoration of the bread and wine or of the real and essential presence of Christ's natural flesh and blood. So it said, we kneel in reverence. We kneel in reverence. Now, you know a Protestant denomination other than the Anglicans or Church of England that do that at the Eucharist, at the celebration of the supper. A very prominent Protestant denomination that has kneeling before the Eucharist, the Methodists. They have taken very much elements of the prayer book and the 39 articles into their own practice. So if you're in a Methodist church and you're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper, you go up and kneel to receive. And then the statement is made, this is not a veneration of the real presence there in the bread and wine, but as this expression of humility and grateful acknowledgement of the benefits of Christ. Okay, then we get to the prayer book of 1659. This is Elizabeth. Elizabeth has been a queen now for about a year, and we get a new edition. The black rubric is gone. After strong, so the prayer book just omits the black rubric altogether. So it's just kneeling with the elements. And it still says spiritually present. But after strong Puritan objection, the black rubric is restored in the 1662 prayer book, but with new wording about the real presence. Christ's presence is real and essential, but not in the flesh as in his natural body. That is still in the Church of England's service in the prayer book. So kneeling for this real and essential presence that Elizabeth insists be in there. And you see what happens here is she has pulled the Catholic element into this Protestant prayer book. At the same time, she's making Church of England required for everyone. Whether you're more Catholic or more Protestant, you're included in the Church of England. It is law. Now, the Protestants will continue. I'm going to give us a picture of the Queen. There are a whole lot of portraits of the Queen. She sat for several. I should also say she was pushed by her advisors to get married so she could have an heir. The old problem of who's going to come in next. And of course, the next king is James I, the Stuart, Mary, Queen of Scots' son, will come in, so she will not have an heir. And they said they could make her mad. You know, they would push her to get married so she could have a child, and she'd get mad at him. Apparently, she got mad a lot. You had to be very careful of her anger. But there were a whole lot of portraits. If you just go on go into your computer and ask for images of Mary, you'll see a whole lot of them. There are a lot of them there. Paintings, a lot, more than certainly we have of others. What happens is then we have increasing numbers of Presbyterians who are now identified clearly as Presbyterians in the Parliament. So much so that I have read a Church of England historian who calls Parliament under Elizabeth Presbyterian. Now, there are other historians that don't say that. They say it's a growing party, but it's not yet the Parliament itself. When we get to the 1640s, we will definitely have a Presbyterian majority with the intention of making the Church of England Presbyterian, giving it the Presbyterian polity, reorganizing. And it will succeed. for a very short period of time, very short. We'll get into that next week, what happens. But you see, the whole point is, who's going to truly reform the church? The Presbyterians are the ones who've got the instruments. They will be the ones initially to make the change, to require the change. Now, one of the things I thought of starting putting in the headline for this whole program was whatever happened to the Presbyterians. Because our heritage as Presbyterians, where do we trace it? Where does it come from in our history? Scotland, not England. What happens to the Presbyterians? And that's part of the history that we get into next week. What happens to the Presbyterians when they are effectively in a majority in the church, but not a majority that can survive because there is opposition coming from what they call independents. And the independents will eventually be called Congregationalists. And they become the Protestant Puritan effort to agree in every way with Presbyterians in dogma, in doctrine. They will accept the Westminster Confession, which is a big Presbyterian work by a Presbyterian parliament in the 1640s. But they will not accept the polity. They will not accept the way the church is organized. They will say the church is organized purely on the basis of congregations, with no presbyters, no synods. Now, that's kind of tricky, because we're going to see how tricky that is when we get there next week. But for a short time, Presbyterians were clearly at the point of power, did declare the Church of England Presbyterian, and it lasted a very short time because, for one thing, of Oliver Cromwell. And that's something we'll talk about next week too, Oliver Cromwell and what he did for and against the church. There's big history. There's a huge history here happening. At different points in this history, there will be pro-Protestant against Protestant, and that ebb and flow will affect migration to New England. Certain events will happen, and then we get a big migration of Puritans. You know, the Presbyterians in the United States, the first Presbyterians are part of that first group of Puritans who go to New England and to Boston from 1630 on, the big migration. Remember the 1620 Mayflower, that's a very small group. So small, they never really make history, except they were the first. But Boston from 1630 on, this is the big migration. And there were Presbyterians among them. And before 1640, there are enough differences coming up between the way the Puritans in Boston want to run the church. They are Congregationalists. And the Presbyterians will separate out, and they will found the first Presbyterian church in America, 1640, on Long Island. And it grows from there. What happens to the Congregational Church, I think we probably all know. Today it's UCC, United Church of Christ. They don't call themselves Congregational anymore. It's a very liberal congregation, denomination, very much affected by the coming of enlightened reason and so forth. Someone I know once made the joke, UCC means Let's see, I'm trying to remember exactly what this is. Christians, no, Unitarians considering Christianity. As I said, the New England goes very Unitarian. The Congregational Church now, UCC, is quite small. So it has a great deal to do with the development of the Unitarian Church in New England. And we'll be talking some about that too, what happens in New England. Things about the Puritans that we have thought aren't exactly right, many of them are. Like they were quick to punish sins. Well, we know they could, we have it clearly stated, they could forgive sins. If there was sincere asking of confession, sexual sins, yes, they would forgive. Notorious sexual sins, they would not. Like drunkenness, they would not. But they were not unforgiving. They were not, their sermons were not hellfire and thunder. They didn't preach hellfire. They preached very reasonable sermons, asking, you know, appealing to the reason of the people in the church. We have clear examples, lots of sermons where we see this. And certainly they were not teetotalers. We see pictures of them in black and white, sometimes brown and white. But the truth is they like color. Women like color. Men wore color. They imported colorful cloths for clothes. Yellows, oranges, reds. So they weren't just that black and white image. There was a whole lot more to them than we usually think. Well, let's transfer over, unless it's a question up to this time. I'm looking at my watch. I do want to get one more thing in, unless you have a question. No question. Yeah.
I don't have the historical discipline that you have. I see this as a big puzzle. And one piece of the puzzle I don't think you mentioned, unless I missed it, was Thomas More. And I wondered how he fit into.
Okay, Thomas. Thomas More was a chancellor for under Henry Head of State. He opposed the marriage to Anne Boleyn. But that was not the kicker. What the kicker was when he was required to subscribe to the head of state, as head of the church, he would not. And Henry took that as treason and he lost his head, right? But he had served Henry up to that point. Now, Thomas More is a very controversial figure. If you remember the movie, A Man for All Seasons, that's a very fictitious story, has been exposed. It's very Catholic, very favorable to Thomas More, but they know today, I mean, it's clear in the research that he was a persecutor. He also whipped himself daily with these lashes. Certainly firmly Catholic, but to the point of being fanatical. I think the new work on Thomas Cromwell is giving a better picture of More than we get from that movie. Remember the movie, Thomas Cromwell is made into a despicable figure, totally despicable. And the one hero in it is Thomas More. Well, that's definitely changed the historical perspective, rather reversed. And by the way, Thomas Cromwell is the great grandfather of Oliver Cromwell. That's remarkable. Any case, yes.
executions were beheadings, primarily for being traitorous, and burnings for religious transgressions.
I'm sorry, I'm a bit hard of hearing, so.
Executions. So burnings by the stake, were they for religious transgressions as opposed to beheadings for being traitorous?
No, no. Beheadings were the privilege of nobility. So there was class difference. If you got beheaded, you were pretty high up. Otherwise, certainly there could be hangings, not just burnings. But burnings were the most public and the most demonstrative. You cross the line, you get burnt, people see it, you know, supposed to be scare you back into line. Yeah. What I wanted to say about James, the person next in line would have been Mary Queen of Scots after Elizabeth, because, again, it goes back to Mary's father came actually related back to Henry VIII. So after Lady Jane Grey is out of the way and Elizabeth dies, the next person in line with royal blood is James VI of Scotland, who becomes James I of England. Now, James is raised as a Presbyterian in Scotland. And throughout his life, he is Presbyterian, but he does not agree that there should be a Presbyterian polity. He does not want synods. He does not want elders. He said, they will turn against me. They are too independent. I got to know them in Scotland. We have to have bishops. So James kept bishops and the Elizabethan settlement. He never questioned it. He kept it. And you had to conform. At the same time, because he was essentially Protestant in the Calvinist tradition, he favored Protestant theology, actually Calvinism. And the archbishops of the time, they all are actually in line with Calvinist theology. Where they differ is in accepting the prayer book and bishops. Remember, the Puritans are pushing against these. Presbyterians are pushing against these. But the bishops, although they're actually, their theology is generally Calvinist, their practice is in line with the prayer book and the vestments. And this will definitely develop into a huge controversy when James I dies and we get into the next king. We have an enormous controversy that will send the Puritans, the first great migration of Puritans to New England, 1630, out of this conflict. But that's for when we get to that. And so you have a picture of James, yes, James Stuart. The Stuarts will maintain their line. You have to be related, directly related to a Stuart to be royalty, to be king or queen, and that will last right on up into the next century with Queen Anne. She's the last Stuart. And we'll talk about that when the time comes. So thank you. You've been attentive, and you have